Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
His name's Steve Satan and he's on your radio.
I can do politics, me.
He's good and wholesome, but it ain't the Christian show.
And it's the second hour of the Politics Show. I'm Steve Satan. He's Martin Summers. We give our thanks to Mark Bradshaw and Steve Pearce, who have now left the building. I don't know, Martin, what would you like to talk about? I've got a load of things I can suggest.
Well, suggest away.
Okay, then. Electric-powered Minis will be built in China. Now, BMW owns the Mini, and I'm wondering whether this is good news or bad news. Does this look like, you know, a British success story, an expansion of production, electric cars, good for the environment, blah, blah, blah? Or is it the slippery slope of, let's keep our options open and open a production plant outside Britain so when it all goes horribly wrong with Brexit, we can still make Minis?
Well, the first thing that occurs to me about this is the Chinese are very interested in electric cars because they've got a problem with oil supply.
They don't have any, basically.
Yeah. A bit like Japan before World War II.
They have a little. They have very little.
Yeah. In other words, they're keen to move to non-fossil fuel technology because if they get the lead in that, you can see that what the positive externalities of that will be for their economy.
Yeah.
So I don't know how viable it is, but I mean, it just shows again how integrated the Chinese communist economy is with the Western capitalist economy, which was not true even 15 years ago.
Yeah.
We really are in an intimate embrace.
Well, they're beginning to show us almost how to do capitalism, aren't they?
Well, they are. One of the things is that it's not when they first moved in that direction, it was rooted in the West as, oh, they've finally come to their senses, they're going to have a capitalist economy. But it's still not a pure capitalist economy. The government still has very big levers that it can pull. And so, for example, the Chinese National Oil Corporation goes around the world and says to people, right, well, we want to have some of your oil. We don't expect to make a profit for 30 years, and we're going to give you all of these side benefits. We'll build you infrastructure, schools, whatever. And, of course, the Western oil multinationals then complain that they're not paying the market price. Now, in actual fact, that is the world market price for oil, which the Chinese National Oil Corporation are playing, and they can offer people a better deal than short-run Western oil corporations, and that's because it is run by the government.
Yeah.
And therefore, is that much, you know, they can take a long-term, long-run view, and the Chinese are hoping to build what they call the One Belt, One Road projects across Central Asia and Southeast Asia, and when they're offering people all sorts of deals, you know, they've got plenty of capital to invest, and of course a lot of the fighting and geopolitical argy-bargy is to try and, you know, the West is trying to sabotage what they're trying to do, and they're trying to extend it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's an immovable force, isn't it? Because, you know, the size of China and its economy is just, you know.
Well, they're going to be the biggest.
Yeah,
undoubtedly, they're going to be the biggest economy on the planet in a few years' time, unless everything goes down the drain. But of course, they hold the US national debt. You know, if there was a collapse in the Western economy, it would affect the Chinese. There could easily be a property price collapse in China if there was a similar thing happening in the West. So it's in nobody's interest. I mean, you know, what the Chinese are saying is it's everybody's interest for us all to cooperate. We're not trying to do this in competition with you in the big sense, you know.
Yeah.
We want to do this stuff. We've got the resources. Why don't you come in on it with us? But, of course, the West is just not prepared, especially with Trump and his America First stuff. They're not prepared to budge up and let the Chinese into the game.
You've opened so many avenues of questioning there. Trump, okay, I mean, you're probably not a fan of Trump, I'm not, and it's very easy to slag him off and say he's an idiot, an incompetent, nasty, blah, blah, blah. But actually, he's a businessman, and is there a sort of, you know, a pragmatic side to Trump's policy, you know, with regards to doing trade with the Chinese?
Well, I think he's pulled in two different directions. I mean, the obviously pragmatic thing to do is to try and do business with them. And not least because the Chinese do hold the US national debt, and the US national debt is going to increase because Trump's policy is to increase the deficit. That's what he's agreed to do. He's going to cut taxes for the wealthy and spend more on military expenditures, which means that the Chinese is relying on the Chinese to buy those US Treasury bills to fund that. But you can see the Chinese and everybody else in the world are getting fed up with basically lending the US money so that it can develop the biggest military on the planet, so it can go around kicking everybody else's sandcastles over and telling them to do as they're told. At a certain point, that's not going to be viable, is it?
No, indeed. Let's just go back to the essence of Chinese capitalism or communism. I mean, how does it work? I've got to confess, I don't know. Are private individuals able to own shares in businesses?
Yes.
Right.
But, I mean, for example, one of the obvious things that they do is they don't allow foreign investors 100% control. They've got to go into local. They've got to form partnerships with local partners.
Right.
A lot of it is local government. At one stage, the town and township and village enterprises in China were the biggest job creations sector for many years, and they are basically local government enterprises with foreign partners.
Right, fair enough.
So the local government then goes into it, and they've decentralised production to quite small towns and villages on the back of that.
Right,
and modified communism with a bit of capitalism thrown in is actually quite an effective setup.
But it sounds to me it's not so much communism, more of a capitalist dictatorship. Would that be true?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the development of the so-called Southeast Asian tigers, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan in an earlier incarnation,
yeah,
they do not follow the laissez-faire free market policy that we pursued in the... For example, when South Korea was developing its industries in the 60s, you couldn't get foreign exchange except from the government, and you had to say, well, what do you want it for? If you want it to buy crates of whiskey, you can't have it. If you want to buy a machine tool from Germany, you can. And in other words, I think the future is of managed capitalism. The problem with China under Mao was that they were marching off in a completely mad direction,
yeah.
Nothing like what anybody else was doing. Whereas if you actually make market-conforming planning, then that's... I mean, in Japan, traditionally, they didn't have a 5-year plan like in Soviet Russia. They had a 15-year plan. You know, we're going to go into textiles, electronics,
right,
widescreen TVs. And they're thinking in terms always of technological improvements. The Ministry of International Trade and Industry in Japan was a crucial lever. And, of course, in Southeast Asia, that's what they do. And so South Korea has probably got a more controlled economy today than China, because China came late to the game.
Yeah.
They pursued a more kind of... let it rip policy,
right.
Whereas South Korea, which was a capitalist state, pursued a more controlled policy, and it was actually run by a right-wing dictatorship.
Right.
But the point is that that's the real world,
yeah,
rather than the fantasy of Liam Fox running around forming, signing trade deals with all and sundry, you know, like Arthur Daly.
Yeah, I mean... I'll put that on the back burner for a sec. Just go back to Mao and, you know, the madness of Mao, which I think any rational observer would say, you know, he was barking mad, you know, idealist, nonsense, whatever. Can you identify a point in the more recent history of China where they sort of, as it were, saw the light?
Well, it was when Mao died.
Right.
And, of course, Deng Xiaoping, who'd been biding his time, the right wing of the Chinese Communist Party, cleared out the Gang of Four. And then they went, you know, they it's very... How China is developing is fascinating, because it is, you know, it's not like other communist countries. It's actually in contention with the capitalist powers.
Yeah.
But it's still got a socialist philosophy. They haven't just given that up.
Okay.
They've still got, you know, they still believe in government intervention. They still believe in having plans. And in actual fact, that's actually quite, you know, they've done an enormous amount. Don't forget, at the end of the Cultural Revolution, the place was a basket case.
Mm.
And it's now not only a basket case, it's overtaking the US as the biggest economy on the planet.
Yeah, yeah. But I read recently, I think I'm right in saying this, that India is on the verge, in terms of population, of overtaking China. Mm. And, you know, India has some modern high tech. Is India likely to sort of challenge China economically?
I think the problem for India is that they've still got a massive non-modern sector in which, perhaps half the population lives. And in China, you know, you've got a modern state where everybody's educated to the highest level they can be, even from a rural area. The life expectancy is far higher than in India. Right. In India, you've still got 40 million manual scavengers who are untouchables, whose job it is to go around cleaning up other people's poo, and that's what they do. And that's that. You know, all of that stuff was smashed by the communist revolution in China.
Yeah.
There used to be a feudal class running small villages and towns in China, but they were all executed and their land was taken off them. And that's a really good way to set up a capitalist economy. You just get rid of the feudal class. Same thing happened in Japan after the war, during the American occupation. The Japanese landlord class was simply smashed.
Right, right.
And of course, that's actually a central thing to do if you want to have a proper capitalist economy.
Well, indeed. What else? Trade deals. You mentioned trade deals and Arthur Daly. So the Brexit fantasy is this, that we leave the shackles of the European Union, and then there are millions of people across the world. The Chinese want our Rolls Royces and the Japanese want our whiskey and so on, and we can make trade deals and trade freely, and it'll all be lovely. What is the flaw in that plan?
Well, I say flaw.
There's probably more than one.
Yeah, well, the obvious thing is that most people don't seem to understand that trade deals are immensely complicated things. I mean, the Doha round took 20-odd years or whatever. You know, the Canadian free trade agreement with the EU took decades to negotiate. Why they imagine that they can just run around and sign deals with people, it just defies belief. And the civil service in Britain are very well aware of this. I mean, the creation of the international trade thing, that never used to exist. So it's a whole department that's been created just for him. And there's a friend of mine who lives down the way here who actually works in the department. And it's like, there's already existing departments, like the Department of Trade supposedly dealing with this. And now we've just created a whole new department to deal with this, but we've already got people dealing with this. What's this all about? And it's a shambolic.
It's the Department of Administrative Affairs, isn't it? You know, from Yes Minister, probably, isn't it?
Yes.
You mentioned that the civil servants know it. It's widely speculated that Theresa May knows it.
Yes.
Those people who don't know it, are they pretending and, you know, that it's going to be all right and saying hang the consequences because we don't care? Or are they actually in denial and believe that it's going to be this fantasy?
I think some of the dimmer ones really believe their own propaganda.
Right.
I think some of the others are determined. It's more to do with who comes out as top. Look at Boris Johnson. He was in favour of staying in the EU until he wasn't.
As was Theresa May.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think, there's loads of quotes from Boris Johnson about how the EU is good and we've got to keep it. And then suddenly he changed his mind because he wanted to be leader of the Tory party and prime minister. So what you've actually got now is a lot of short-term thinking by people at the top who are just thinking in terms of their own careers, basically. Yeah. And that's all it boils down to.
But even then, you've got to make Brexit a success, because if you're the Brexit, you know, campaigner, cheerleader, and Brexit goes horribly wrong, which you and I believe it will, you're on a sort of political suicide mission, aren't you?
Well, you are. I mean, and that's probably why it's better to let them deal with their own mess in relation to this. Although I think it's becoming clearer, as we were saying in the first hour, this question of a customs union is going to be the key.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's essential to, and of course, if we're in a customs union, we can't do deals with anybody else, which is why the right wing of the Tory party hate it, because they want this whole thing of we can't do deals with anybody else anyway.
Mm.
You know, even if we left the customs union, we'd be then to WTO rules. But of course, Trump's about to rip up the WTO rules.
Right.
So
right.
In other words, there won't even be WTO rules.
So what happens then? Okay, if there are no WTO rules and we have Brexit, a hard Brexit in about a year's time, what happens? Is it that I cannot trade at all until there's an agreement?
Well, you can do, other people will start putting up tariffs to British goods.
Right.
Now, what Patrick Minford, the in-house Brexit economist, argues is that we shouldn't put up tariffs to their goods. we will have, which is basically the policy that Britain used to pursue when it had the empire, free trade. Yeah. So even if other people put up tariffs, we won't. But that means, of course, you're actually, and Minford basically admits that we will lose all industry and agriculture. We'll have to go. And then we will specialise in something else.
Right.
So it's an absolutely, you know, wreck the farm policy.
Yeah. What can we specialise in? Premier League football and Scotch whisky. Well, that'll keep the economy alive, won't it?
Yes, indeed, that's right. I mean, it's all about services and so on. Yeah. But of course, and that's really the City of London. But the City of London will definitely lose out if it's not inside the European Union. You know, the stuff will go to Frankfurt, Dublin, etc.
But again, it's coming back to my... There must be some incredibly powerful people and incredibly powerful corporations in the City of London and linked to the City of London that must see this disaster coming and must be surely squeezing the levers of power very hard.
They are. Well, Philip Hammond is their representative in the cabinet.
Okay.
And, you know, the funders of the Tory party are generally not happy. But you've got billionaires who have got their own political agendas, you know, the Rupert Murdochs and Aaron Bankses, and they've got, the same thing's happened in the US. You've got billionaires chucking money at both political parties, and of course it then becomes who can get the most billionaires and who's got the most money to push the propaganda.
Yeah. Are we looking, I mean, whoever wrote Article 50... And it was a British guy, I believe, wasn't it?
I don't know, but it may be so.
Probably got it a bit wrong. I mean, there is a legitimate case for any country having the option to leave the European Union.
Yeah.
And surely then, if you want to make that option available, you've got to make it workable in the sense that the transition is going to be difficult and there should be an allowance for making independent trade deals before leaving the European
Union.
Well,
I mean, the fact is that they triggered Article 50 when they didn't have to. The other EU countries were not expecting Britain to trigger it. They were thought there'd be all sorts of preliminary discussions, and then eventually, you know, when everybody was satisfied with the direction of travel, then it would be triggered. But for internal political reasons, Theresa May triggered it quick, because that made her Brexit supporters happy. Yes, we're definitely leaving. And of course, they're now in a position where all of these real-world objections are piling up. So their determination, the Rees-Moggs and others, is to get it done and get it, you know, smash the windows, crash the car, and then it's done. Whatever happens, we're out. And that's where they're at now. They just want to get out before everybody works out how bad it's going to be.
Right.
And then they're just hoping that on the other side of that, things will be better. And I think it is. It's going to be interesting because the Brexit recession, which we're going to have, will be part of a general recession. The EU is not in a good shape.
Right.
The US isn't in a good shape. Yeah, it may be that they'll be able to disguise the fact that Brexit has been a disaster because everything else is a disaster simultaneously. But I can't see that they can rationally discuss it as going to be anything other than. I mean, you know, if they were honest, they'd say that we want freedom and we're prepared to pay a price for it.
Right.
That's what sovereignty generally means.
Yeah.
Where the PKK turn around to their supporters in Turkey and say, we want sovereignty for Kurdistan, but we're going to have to fight and die for it. We've taken 30,000 casualties so far, another 30,000 and we think we might get it. That's what sovereignty's about.
Right, right.
It's not about getting a better life and just voting for this and then walking away. Sovereignty is a much more, you know, it's a very serious issue.
Yeah, although it's also a very sort of emotional, nebulous, pointless issue in a way, isn't it?
It's
something that appeals to your heart, doesn't it? I've got freedom, I've got independence, I'm my own master, and yet...
Yes, well, it's the speech in Braveheart, isn't it? You know, and all the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, what tends to happen, and this certainly happened in Yugoslavia when I was an aid worker over there, is because the economy is in such a mess, politicians cannot promise people improvements in their living standards, but they can promise them that we're going to get those, whoever they are, you know, the Croats, the Serbs, the Mexicans, whoever the other is going to get what they deserve, because that's all they've got to offer. Because in actual fact, the economy's gradually going down the drain,
right.
The pie's shrinking,
yeah.
And all they've got to offer then is all of these slogans and wishes.
Looking at the global economy, let's suppose for the moment that the rest of the world is doing all right. If Brexit were to cause a UK recession, is the UK's economy large enough to trigger a worldwide recession on the
back of that? Well, I think that would be an interesting development if the recession in the Brexit recession in Britain came first. Then of course that would then affect the Europeans and so on and so forth. You know, and don't forget, the Brexit could be part of a general crack up in Europe. Yeah,
because
it would just be one part of the crack up. And of course, the people in the Daily Mail and the Telegraph going, oh, yes, but look at how badly the Europeans are doing, and aren't we going to be walking away from it? But they're our main trading partners. If the European Union goes down the drain, we go down with it, and that's the reality.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Maybe. Okay, let's talk about the world economy and currencies, because we mentioned, you know, the strength of the yuan. Is the yuan, isn't it, the Chinese currency? Isn't it the yuan renminbi or something?
Well, the renminbi is the internal.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
they've got quite strong capital controls. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So you've got your yuan, which is your international stuff.
Yeah.
And renminbi is what they spend. You know, what you spend inside China.
Oh, really? So it's actually two.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Oh, yeah, because they're not a capitalist economy. We're a communist country. We don't have to run it like that.
Right. I didn't even imagine that was possible, really, but I suppose it is, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, most international trade is done in dollars, or at least it's marked in dollars, isn't it?
Well, the key international trade that's done in dollars is oil, because a deal was done by the Saudis with the Americans in the 1970s that the Saudis, as the biggest producers of oil, would always sell their oil in dollars, and so that if you want to buy oil, you've got to have dollars, which of course means that everybody's got to have dollars, which means that the US can print dollars, and everybody's got to have them. And of course what's going on is happening very shortly is the Chinese are developing a petro yuan based in Shanghai,
right,
which can be changed for gold. And the Venezuelans are moving in this direction as well. They're bringing in cryptocurrencies which are related to oil and also to gold. And, of course, both the Chinese and the Russians have got quite a big gold mining industry.
Yeah.
And the Chinese and the Russians are piling up gold. So they're preparing to take the dollar down and replace it with a gold-backed currency.
Yeah. Now, I don't quite understand this because I can understand that, you know, oil is priced in dollars, but I don't actually have to pay for it in dollars, do I? Why can't Britain pay Saudi Arabia in the equivalent amount of pounds?
You're not, well, because the Saudis agreed with the Americans that they wouldn't sell it for anything other than dollars.
Right.
Although the Chinese are saying to the Saudis, do you want, you know, we'll do a deal with you.
Yeah.
Sell it in yuan. Yeah,
but even if it's dollars, I mean, I can, you know, we don't actually have to have physical dollars, do we? We don't even have to go through an American bank. You know, I can say to Saudi Arabia, you give me 100 million barrels of oil, we'll call that, you know, $10 billion, and then I'll pay you back in the equivalent amount of value of cars.
In order to get around the sanctions on Iran, China has been, you know, basically doing barter deals
with Iran.
So on. So there are ways around it,
yeah.
But the petrodollar system is the key to the U.S. imperialist infrastructure,
right?
Yeah, they got. If you remember, the Libyan gold dinar and Saddam Hussein's decision to sell oil in euros, triggered invasions,
right?
Because once you set up a viable alternative to the dollar, the dollar then goes down the drain. The US cannot sustain its budget deficits, and there's an internal crisis in the US, which could be a revolutionary crisis if you think about it.
Yeah.
If the dollar crashes, you've got a country where everybody's armed to the teeth, which could make civil war in China in the 1940s look like a Sunday afternoon tea party.
It'll be 1929 all over again. What does, for example, Saudi Arabia do with their dollars?
Well, they recycle it into buying weaponry from the Americans.
Right, right.
Yeah, and also the ruling class are very integrated,
yeah.
So the Bin Laden family and the Bush family have been working together for years and years and years. But of course, the Saudis may at some point switch sides,
yeah.
Or they may, or it may just be that an alternative system of doing business will evolve. But of course, there's an enormous amount of pressure for that not to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the military manoeuvres by the West are to prevent exactly that. You know, they cannot allow. I mean, Libya was turning into a real threat because, you know, they had oil, they had gold, they had a stable setup with a you know, big, you know, they were talking about developing the Libyan gold dinar as a basis for inter-African trade and so on.
Right.
That's the point at which, you know, Gaddafi was unceremoniously removed, and it's not an accident.
So what do you think is going to happen in Venezuela then? Because that's much closer to the US, isn't it?
And well, they're about to have a presidential election.
Yeah.
They've called that. The opposition are talking of boycotting it. But if Maduro, and he won, the socialists won the local elections about 2 months ago.
Right.
In regional elections. So there's been an awful lot of huffing. It's a very divided society. Yeah. I mean, most Latin American countries are. You've got a small minority at the top who own everything, and a large proportion of the population who are pretty poor, and that leads to quite strong social polarisation in all of these countries, and the Venezuela is no exception. Of course, Venezuela has also been under sanctions from the US. They did quite well when the oil price, of course, being forced down at the minute by the Saudis and others to mess with the Russians and the Venezuelans. The oil price gets moved up and down by the Americans and their allies as a means of manipulating world affairs. So pushing the oil price up messes up the Chinese, but it helps the Russians.
Right.
Pushing the oil price down helps the Chinese.
Yeah, you're right. Helps the Chinese, but at the expense of the Russians.
At the expense of the Russians. Because the Russians, and there's a struggle going on within the US ruling class about who they want to fight first, the Chinese or the Russians. So you need a low oil price to mess the Russians up, but that helps the Chinese.
Yeah. But, I mean, Russia, you say that, though. Russia is actually the world's largest producer of oil. So they're
not the largest, but they're one of the largest.
No, they are the largest. They export. Saudi Arabia has the largest reserves, but Russia exports more. It's pumping harder, I think.
Well, it's as John McCain said, it's not really a country, it's just a gas station pretending to be a country.
But Russia, though, presumably Russia's exporting its oil in dollars.
At the moment, yes.
And was that always the case, even under communism?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and that's what that's... And the oil price was forced down as a means to bring them down, and it worked. You know,
right,
that undermined them.
Obviously, I don't have any encyclopedic memory of the oil price.
Well, I mean,
there's
a very interesting book which I've forgotten the full title of, which I read not long ago. I mean, basically, oil prices are determined by political arm twisting behind the scenes. It's not a market in any you know, like a market for apples or oranges.
Yeah? Well, there must be an element of market, isn't it? You can't get around the sort of fundamentals of supply and demand.
No, you can't. But
you
can tweak it pretty fundamentally. I mean, you know, one of the struggles going on at the minute is who's going to supply natural gas to Europe. And, of course, the German government and the Russian government have agreed that they're going to set up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will run under the Baltic and bring natural gas to North Germany. But that's being opposed by the Americans, the Poles, the Ukrainians, because they see that they'll be cut out there. But it makes perfect sense from the point of view of the Russian, of the German industrialists.
Yeah, yeah.
So these kind of... But if the pipeline isn't built... Because, the Americans are putting pressure on for it not to be built. The Germans are resisting it. The British, of course, are siding with the Americans, as we always do. Then obviously, the price will not change.
There's a pan-European gas network, isn't there?
Yeah.
And it's in all our interests to have stability of supply and, you know...
Yeah, well, I mean, even during the Cold War, the Russians never cut off the supply. A lot of the stuff ran through Ukraine, mm-hmm. and when Ukraine and Russia fell out, the Ukraine stopped supplying Western Europe to put pressure on Russia, and that's why the Russians are saying, well, let's just cut them out.
Right.
And of course, they could send it through Poland, but they don't trust the Poles would be able to switch off the tap.
Right.
So that's why they're going under the Baltic. The other suggestion was that they were putting out supply lines going through Turkey, Greece, and through the Balkans.
Well, we
and
can't trust the Turks, can we?
Well, I mean, but the point is that South Stream pipeline is now back on being discussed.
Right.
When the Russians and the Turks had fallen out, that all fell through, and then they were looking for another route for it. And the Austrians, who would be at the end of this, are all in favour of it.
Yeah.
Now you can see that in actual fact it makes a lot of sense for Europe to cooperate with Russia to develop the One Belt, One Road initiatives with China.
Yeah.
But of course, who's opposed to that? The Americans. And of course, on that basis, the British are spoilers within all of that to keep the system, you know, the Anglo-Zionist system in position, you know.
The Anglo-Zionist conspiracy.
Well, it's not a conspiracy. It's just that these are the interests that are at work.
Yeah. Oil. Okay. So we get our gas from mostly from Russia, a bit from Norway, a little bit of our own. Are there any other significant suppliers of gas to
Algeria? Europe? Sends a bit in.
Right.
I mean, but if you put it in tankers and move it, and Qatar.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things about the Syrian war was about which pipelines were going to go through Syria and in which directions and who was going to control them. And, you know, these pipelines either get built or don't get built, like the one that was going to run through Afghanistan, but, you know, to to the south from the Caucasus.
Right.
And if they don't get built because there's a war or whatever, then the situation doesn't change.
Yeah.
And if they do get built, then it does change. And so a lot of the wars and fightings are about A, controlling the sources of gas and oil, and B, controlling the mechanisms for getting it out and moving it to wherever it's got to go.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's geopolitics.
Right.
It's not really market economics, is it?
No. I read that one of the world's biggest hedge funds is gambling against some major European corporations. This is reported in the Daily Mail, so you can take that with a pinch of salt. The firm is called Bridgewater, and who are they shorting? They're shorting Siemens and Unilever and probably a few others as well. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the Daily Mail are reporting it because it shows that the Europeans are going to fail before we do, and therefore, you know, Brexit is going to succeed. That's the logic.
Right.
That's the logic of that from the Daily Mail's point of view.
Yeah,
I think, you know, it's shorting things makes perfect sense if you're on the brink of a major meltdown, doesn't it? That's where you need to be.
And obviously, you're I mean, if you were a billionaire hedge fund owner or operator, would you be shorting major European?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
right. Okay.
And
right.
Yeah, because you can. Basically, I think look what happened when they tried to raise interest. They've talked about raising interest rates, the Federal Reserve, and immediately there's been a wobble. It's like the taper tantrum of a few years ago. The pile of debt that's now been built up, and it's essentially private debt, some of which has been publicly, you know, socialised. So the governments are in debt because they took over those private debts, and the private sector is massively in debt. You've had all of this kind of stock buybacks funded by borrowing by companies in the US. Any raise in interest rates will cause a major crash. I think nothing has happened within 10 years since the last crash, and they didn't do anything at all to change the way in which the system worked. They've just done exactly the same thing and built an even bigger bonfire.
I think in the case of the Bank of England, though, I think there's been a change of policy in the sense that they're giving lots and lots of advance warning of which way the wind is blowing.
Well,
but
it was actually when Mark Carney suggested that Britain would raise interest rates.
Yeah.
That was one of the triggers for the recent turmoil. So even the bank... See, because... If we turn the cycle now and we start seeing interest rates rising, then there's a potential for an avalanche crash because of the derivatives market and all the rest of it.
Sure,
and
but those shock waves are going to be lessened the more they're predicted and accounted for in advance, aren't
well,
they?
Well, no, because but I think the thing is that what the market traders believe is that whatever happens, the governments will bail them out. So you've got a huge moral hazard scenario built up here now. And they're probably right.
Yeah.
I think that when push comes to shove, either they won't raise interest rates, or if they do and it starts to cause problems, then they'll stop.
Right.
And they'll go back to trying to print money. And that's probably right. That's all you can do.
But interest rate rises are generally speaking done as a sort of brake on the economy, aren't they? When it's overheating. And I don't see any evidence of that in any economy at the moment.
Well, no, but I mean, the fact is that there's a pretense. I mean, if you've got, you know, the very limited growth that we've had over the last few years, and it's not been anything spectacular, and that's all based on zero interest rates and negative interest rates in places like Japan, then that means that it's not real. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not real. And as soon as you raise interest rates, and eventually you will have to, then it'll just disappear like snow in summer.
In general, Martin, you're always painting a picture of the world economy as a house of cards about to collapse.
Well, that's because it is. But the fact is that it can only collapse once. And it's been so hard to predict when because they've basically gone for unconventional policies. In the past, they would always have they'd have raised interest rates years ago. They'd have just done it.
Right.
And at that point, but they can't. And at that point, and of course, things like quantitative easing and also the plunge protection team in the US, they're buying equities. The same thing happens in Japan.
Right.
They go in, the stock market wobbles and the government goes in and props it up. They're not supposed to do that.
Right, right.
But they do. And of course, it's very hard to make predictions when they are pursuing very unconventional policies, stuff that you shouldn't do, according to the textbook. I mean, Trump's just agreed that he's going to massively increase the US budget deficit. It's like all those years of cutting things to try and get it under control.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
out the window. Yeah. Not doing any of that anymore. And of course, they all had a euphoria on the back of that. You know, there was when Trump was trying to be elected, he said this is a stock market in a bubble. And then it's now risen by 30% since he said it was in a bubble. Now, that is a bubble, and that's going to burst.
Yeah,
now, what should have happened after 2008 was that everybody should have, you know, there should have been a complete change of attitude towards all of this. But it didn't happen. There was about a year where you know, there was a sort of sackcloth and ashes approach. And then, you know, basically the flyboys are back in charge where they always were. And they are, you know, this is, to my mind, I can't see how anybody objectively can see this as anything other than the biggest bubble in history. And the end of it is bound to be a burst, because that's what happens with bubbles.
Well, I was going to ask you, if you are a government and you realise that, you know, the prices of shares in your economy are hugely overvalued and are going to collapse, is there any action you can take to kind of steady it and stop it crashing catastrophically?
I would say that it's probably too late now.
Right. That's no, but in general.
In 2008, you've bailed out the private sector. Mm. You then read them the Riot Act. You know, we're going to set up public sector banking. For example, I mean, in Iceland, which we might want to talk about, the two banks, Landsbanki and Ifsafe, until 2003 were both owned by the government. So it's only a small scale, but that's 100% publicly owned banking.
Yeah, yeah.
Privatised, and then within 3 or 4 years, the banks are supposedly on paper worth several times your GNP. Which, of course,
that's not sustainable, is it?
No. But the point is that Alan Brown in the US talks about this, and I don't know if you've ever heard of the Bank of North Dakota.
Yes, I've heard of it.
The Bank of North Dakota is owned by the state of North Dakota, and it was set up in the early part of the 20th century by progressive politicians, you know, who were fed up with Wall Street ripping off the local farmers and so on. So they set up their own bank, and it's still going strong. It underpins the finances of the state, so that North Dakota, which is a Republican state nowadays, is the only solvent state in the union.
Right.
And it's got a publicly owned bank at the heart of it. And you could imagine Britain, after the banking sector collapsed and the government steps in to take it over, well, the banking sector becomes public sector.
Yeah.
But can you imagine? It's perfectly feasible. And we could have done it, but we didn't. And the Labour government decided that they were going to create quangos to run the publicly run banks, like RBS. In other words, RBS was told to get back to the gaming table and try and get back the losses they'd made. Whereas what they should have done is said, right, we're going to completely reconceptualise what the banking system's for. It's not there for speculative gains. It's there to, you know, channel savings to productive enterprises. And we're talking earlier about Southeast Asia. In Japan, all enterprises were funded by loans from the post office for many, many years. Yeah, everybody had their money in the post office, which was owned by the government. And then the post office savings were then lent, but only to productive enterprises with long-term plans.
Right, right.
And so that's how they built themselves up.
It seems that what happened in the States a while back was they separated. It was a sensible move to separate out the commercial banking from the gambling banking.
Yes, that was the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah,
and under the Clinton era, they were lobbied by Wall Street to, you know, we don't need this stuff anymore. Let's allow us to. I mean, Goldman Sachs is classified as a bank so that it can receive federal funds.
Right.
But it was only classified as a bank once it was on the verge of bankruptcy during the crash.
Yeah. Why did the banks want the end to that separation? Because surely you can carry on gambling on your gambling arm as much as you want. What's the problem?
Because the resources of the retail arm gives you much more scope to gamble.
Oh, of course, you're gambling other people's money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And especially if the government bails you out if you fail,
yeah.
Then there's no. I mean, the gamblers in Wall Street have made more money since the crash than they did before the crash, which is extraordinary.
Yeah,
you know, there has
yeah.
been no crisis for them. The crisis has been pushed entirely onto the population at large, which is why we're talking about people sleeping in the streets and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
and there's a very good book by Philip Morawski, who's more of an anthropologist than an economist, really, about how they've managed to pull this. You know, in 2008, you know, suddenly they were caught bang to rights, fingers in the till, all the rest of it. You know, a lot of them should have been sent to prison because they were forging loans and all the rest of it.
Right, right.
But none of that happened, and they were able to turn the whole thing round into, oh, it was everybody's to blame except us. And not only did they escape blame, they've actually managed to manipulate the situation. If the government backs you up, then you've got massive amounts of resources to go and. I mean, RBS has just come into profit very recently because we've spent an awful lot of money putting them back in the position. And of course, what will happen now is they'll start talking about selling it back to the private sector.
Yeah.
So the state has taken all the losses,
yeah.
and then we just hand it back to the private sector so they can make all the profit.
Hasn't that happened already? Hasn't the state sold quite a lot of RBS back?
Yeah, well, they've sold a lot of it, but at less than they paid for it.
Right.
So we've lost out.
That's rather silly, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Why have they done that?
Because the private sector is better than the public sector.
Right.
Don't you know that, Steve? It's just better in every possible way. Better for us, anyway, the people that make money out of these things.
Right, right.
Yeah? Mm. I mean, the political power of the financial sector is enormous. And especially, you know, before the state stepped in, their political power is enormous. And they've actually, by the state stepping in, their political power has become greater.
Right.
So they dictate. And if they had a stable setup, that would just be a normal exploitation setup. You know, it's a stable setup, but it's not a stable setup. The speculative, the pressures for speculation now are, you know, if you can't, you can easily make more money speculating on derivatives than you can by building a better widget.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, at that point, why would anybody build a better widget? And they don't, which is why productivity is going down. They're not investing in new technology. They're investing in financial manipulation.
Yeah.
And that's what will happen. If you allow people to make money through financial manipulation, then they stop doing the other stuff. It's not both. You can have both. You can't really have both.
No.
It's one or the other.
Right. Here's a subject that I'm sure you and Tony have discussed quite a lot, but it seems to have been rearing its ugly head again, possibly in the light of later revelations, which you can possibly enlighten us about. Russiagate.
Yeah. Well, I, as you know, I do fairly regular stuff for Russia Today. I'm on Russia Today International TV, and I've been asked to comment on this quite a bit. If you go back to the heart of this, there's an awful lot of froth.
Of course,
the heart of it was that WikiLeaks released the Democratic National Committee's internal emails, which showed that the primary for who would be the Democratic candidate had been rigged in favour of Hillary Clinton and against Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And that was leaked via WikiLeaks.
Do we know who rigged it and how?
Well, the emails show how they rigged it. They did all sorts of different things. There were the superdelegates, which were already there anyway. So Hillary Clinton had all the superdelegates who were not voted for by anybody.
Right.
But they went to the stage of things like hacking into electronic voting machines and stuff like this. Don't forget that the primary is organised at a local level all over the US. And therefore, there's plenty of scope for, you know, fixing it. And these internal emails showed that they had fixed it. Yeah? And the Democratic National Committee is supposed to be independent. It's not supposed to be rigging it in favour of one lot or another. Anyway, that was leaked. It was actually leaked. It wasn't hacked. It was leaked because Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, flew to Washington to take to take possession of the leak from the leaker.
Yeah, okay.
And some people think that that leaker was Seth Rich, who was the Democratic National Committee's IT whiz, who then was subsequently murdered.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the point is, as Putin pointed out, nobody disputes what the core of this is that the Democratic primaries were rigged. Now, you've got to think how important this is in the US system, because you've got two official parties in the US.
Yeah.
So if you can rig the internal elections in that official party, then you've rigged the election. Wouldn't be the same in any other country, because there aren't just two official parties. But the American system is actually a controlled democratic system where you've got to basically be in one party or the other. And so if you rig one party's internal, and what could have happened, you see, if Bernie Sanders had been the candidate against Trump, it's quite likely he might have won.
Yeah.
The opinion polls showed that he would. And therefore, you've got a situation where Bernie Sanders should have been the president of the United States, and instead you've ended up with Trump. Now, what the FBI then said was that the Russians had hacked this out and passed it to the media, to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks deny that. Both
right.
Assange and Craig Murray, who's working closely with Assange, said that no, it wasn't hacked. And it wasn't from the Russians. But in any case, as Putin pointed out, the real scandal here is that the primary was rigged.
Yeah, yeah.
And the FBI admits that the primary was rigged, but they said that the Russians, by publicising this, are undermining US democracy. And I would say, well, the people undermining US democracy are the people who rigged the primary. It's nothing to do with the Russians.
Yeah. Well, okay, I mean, we hear in the news this noise generally that the Russians are these sort of uber hackers interfering
yeah.
with democracy generally.
Yes.
Now, you know, one can have one's suspicions about Putin and his cabal, but I have my doubts about whether Russia has the technological edge over the USA or GCHQ or whoever.
Well, I mean, I think what's going on here is they're projecting onto others what they themselves do. They put in a lot of effort. Did you know that in Britain we've got something called Brigade 77?
Never heard of Brigade
77. Brigade 77 was set up 2 or 3 years ago. It's got 1,000 people working for them, all of which are British Army officers,
mm-hmm.
all of which must be paid at least 30 grand, probably 50, 60 grand each. And do you know what they do all day? They sit on their computers creating bots to interfere in other people's elections and engage in psychological warfare.
Right.
And we pay for that.
Right, right.
Now, of course, when they engage in psychological warfare against other countries, they're also engaging in psychological warfare against the population of their own country. So, for example, when the collapse of the big PR firm... what's the name of them? The ones that,
not Saatchi & Saatchi.
No, not Saatchi & Saatchi. It's another one in the US.
Oh, right.
I can't remember the name of them now. It's just on the top of my... Anyway, they went down...
I'll look it up.
Yes, it doesn't... I can't remember the name of them offhand. But anyway, they went down because they were doing stuff for the Guptas in South Africa.
Right.
You remember the...
No, it doesn't ring a bell, I'm afraid.
I can't remember the name of them. It's on the tip of my tongue, but it's gone.
I'll get it.
But anyway, they're in real trouble because they were shown that they'd been interfering in South African politics in favour of the Guptas, who were close to Zuma. And,
it's not Bell Pottinger.
Bell Pottinger,
right.
That's right.
But that's a British firm.
That's a British firm.
Oh,
that's
right.
Anyway, they're in serious trouble because they were caught out doing that in South Africa. Anyway, one of the things they did for the US government was to create fake Al Qaeda videos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they had a contract to create fake Al Qaeda videos. Now, that's psychological warfare.
Yeah.
But of course, it's psychological warfare against your own population, because these fake Al Qaeda videos float around. People say, oh, Al Qaeda's saying this, Al Qaeda's saying. No, but that's Bell Pottinger pretending to be Al Qaeda,
right.
Paid for by the taxpayer.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, can you see what's wrong with that?
Well, I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, that's what's going on. The West has engaged in this kind of psychological warfare games, cyber war, for ages, yeah? To get rid of, they tried to set up a whole Twitter stuff in Cuba so they could get young people, tweeting each other or whatever in opposition to the government.
Mm.
They spend an awful lot of money and time on this. Now, the Russians, as you quite rightly say, haven't got the resources.
Well,
and in any case, they generally don't have a policy of trying to. There's going to be a lot of interference in the Russian presidential election. The West is going to spend a lot of money to try and stop Putin. They won't succeed, but they're going to spend a lot of money on it. And the Russians get fed up with that.
What I was suggesting that Russia, not that Russia couldn't or wouldn't do it, but they didn't have any special advantage. There's nothing that they can do that we can't, and probably vice versa.
Indeed. Also, the Russians are trying to, they're trying to create a situation where they say, well, we don't interfere with internal affairs. And this is we're talking about the Chinese National Oil Company earlier. Mm. They say, we're not going to tell you how to run your country. We want to do a deal with you, but your internal politics are your affair. And we're not going to, we have got no interest in trying to steer them in any direction. We're just trying to get a long-term relationship with you. Now, in actual fact, the West does engage in an awful lot of jiggery-pokery in this sphere. We've got our own brigade of people doing exactly that. And therefore, it becomes easy to accuse the other side of doing what you're doing. And I'm not saying that the Russians don't have their cyber warfare capabilities. They probably do. But what does that actually mean? I mean, these 13 people that have been indicted by Mueller are basically individual Russian citizens who've posted minuscule posts about the US election, many of them after the election, some of them pro Hillary, some of them pro Trump. There's a whole spread of things. But aren't Russian individuals allowed to have opinions about the US election?
Probably, yeah.
But that's all it boils down to.
Right, right.
And of course, in actual fact, in terms of the actual amount of money spent on the election by the main campaigns, there was huge billions of dollars chucked at it.
Yeah.
And
a few,
£100,000 was spent by some Russians trying to get their tuppence halfpenny into. How does that affect the result? And the answer is it doesn't.
Right.
But as I think, coming back to the key thing, which was the rigging of the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
That's key. Because Sanders should have won it.
Right, right.
And if he'd won it, he would have beaten Trump. That's what the opinion polls showed. Because a lot of these Rust Belt states liked the kind of things that Sanders was saying.
That's true. But the opinion polls still had Hillary in the lead. And in fact, Hillary scored more votes, didn't she?
Well, she did.
Trump,
she did. So, I mean, that's another thing about the US system.
Yeah.
The US system has got two official parties, and the person who gets the least votes wins.
Well, as in this country as well.
Well, yes, because of first past the post.
Yeah, 1951 and 1974.
What you will see now in the Russian setup is, because they created a modern democracy relatively recently, they've gone for state of the art.
Right.
So this presidential election in Russia will have two rounds. If Grudinin, who's the communist candidate, can get enough votes to keep Putin under 50%, then there will have to be a runoff.
Right, right.
As in France.
Yes, I was going to say, it's like the French system, isn't it?
Like it's unlikely, because Putin is very strong, because he's in power, he's done a lot of, he's improved people's living standards, he's massively increased the country's standing in the world, people agree with his policies on Ukraine and Crimea, he's probably going to win handsomely. I mean, the latest opinion polls give him 60 to 70% of the vote, so right. There probably won't even be a second round. But Grudinin might get into a second round, who's the Communist Party candidate. But even if he did get into a second round, Putin would probably win.
I just want to contrast how, if, as you say, which you're probably right, Putin is popular in Russia. In the West, we see him as a bit of a bad boy, don't we? A bit of a sort of slightly corrupt, not quite a dictator, but not quite playing by the rules.
Putin, when he first came to power, just about like Assad in Syria, was regarded as a pro-Western candidate. He was seen as somebody that we could do business with, who would be, basically Putin won the 1998 election by basically, not to put too fine a point on it, the bombs in Ryazan and Moscow that killed hundreds of people in working class blocks of housing were blamed on the Chechens.
Yeah.
And then Putin rode in on a white horse to keep the communists out. Zyuganov was going to win the election.
Right.
Who was the communist candidate. And Zyuganov actually said, when he was standing up, he said, it's the Communist Party versus the KGB. I call on the people to vote for the Communist Party. Now, I thought they were going to run Zyuganov again, because he's like a Bernie Sanders figure in Russian politics, the man who stuck to his guns all the way, But they've chosen instead this guy Grudinin, who's a young... I mean, Zyuganov is an old guy now. That's the West were perfectly happy for Putin to win that election to keep Zyuganov out. Because if the communists had won a democratic election in Russia, that would have ended all of the Cold War propaganda. So they've just voted the communists. And, of course, they voted the communists in all other East European countries.
Right.
Poland included. everybody voted at least once for a communist government or post-communist government because they didn't like the free market. I mean, for most ordinary people, I lived in Poland during the free market era, people were absolutely shocked by the collapse in their living standards.
Right.
They hadn't expected that.
Okay.
They thought, because they could see on TV that in the West people had, you know, cars and TVs and foreign holidays, that they were going to get that. But yeah, of course they didn't get that.
No.
It wasn't like that at all. And the death rate, I used to work in the region, I used to have to write reports for my bosses at the time. The death rate in all these countries went through the roof during the transition to capitalism.
Right.
So it was a very, very iffy. And of course, the former communists, in fact, won elections in every single state.
Right.
Apart from in Russia.
So what's, I mean, the Eastern European, the former communist countries, they are still capitalist countries, though, aren't they?
Well, they are now.
Right.
They are now. But of course, in Russia, for example, they've still got a state-run oil industry.
Right.
A state-run railway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they allowed to have a state-run railway? They are. But the head of the state-run railway, Steve,
yeah,
has been put on the list of people that were not to do business with and not allowed to travel, etc., because he runs a state-run railway. Because
really?
They shouldn't be allowed to have that, should
right.
they?
No, definitely not. No, whatever. Whatever next? Because we've never had a state-run railway in this country,
no,
have we?
No, thank goodness for
and,
that.
And also, when the capitalist rail franchises collapse, we don't put in a state-run temporary holding company
between
2009 and 2015, do we?
Yeah, so Putin is on the centre-right of Russian politics,
yeah,
but the centre-right is, they still believe in government intervention. A bit like the Chinese communists. They're free marketeers, but only to a point.
So, I mean, are they a bit like, you know, old One Nation Tories in a
yes,
way?
Yes, yeah, yes. That's Putin's appeal to the people.
Right. Okay.
You know, we are competent, and we're not just going to have a free market free-for-all, because they had a free market free-for-all under Yeltsin.
Yeah.
It was absolutely catastrophic.
Right.
Basically what Putin did is he disciplined the oligarchs.
Listen, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much, Martin Summers. I will be back next week, you will be back next week,
mm-hmm,
and we'll discuss more of the same and loads of different stuff instead. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Satan, this is BCFM, and you're listening to The Politics Show. I think is it Arabian Nights next? I don't know.
I believe it is.
I'll be back on your radio on Monday as well, Monday lunchtime for The Steve Satan Show. Thanks.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.